Hi, welcome to the 2017 version of Candidates Corner. I'm Dave Danielson, and today we're going to be interviewing Chris Bandazian. Chris, welcome.
Dave, good
welcome.
To see you.
Good
Thank
to see you.
You
again as well. Well, this is your second or third try?
Concluding my third term.
You're concluding your third term. Well, thank you very much for your service. I think that's very important that you've done that. And prior to that, you served a number of terms on the Zoning Board of Adjustment, ZBA.
I served on the ZBA since 1992. This is actually the conclusion of my 25th year.
Wow.
In service to the town. And back when you were on the town council, I served a 10-month appointment to fill Councillor Egan's seat,
right.
He became ill.
Right,
so
right.
You got me on my start here.
Well, that's great. Great. And thank you again for your service. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Can you give the folks a little bit of background about yourself? Like, where are you from? You're a new grandfather. I think that's very important that you're a new grandfather. Congratulations.
Thank you, Dave. But
give us some background, education background, professional background, if you can.
Sure. Grew up in Connecticut. Went to school originally to go into medical research, and for various political and funding reasons in the 1980s, switched careers to law school. I graduated from BC Law School in 1985 and began working here in New Hampshire. Marianne, my wife, who's library director now, and I moved to town with our then two-year-old son, back in 1985. We have two boys, both graduates of West High School, both with great professional jobs down in the Boston area. My youngest is an industrial designer. My oldest, Max, is a software engineer. And he and his wife, Lindsay, have just graced us with a now 8-month-old grandson who looks and acts just like him. So it's wonderful.
It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
It is.
It's really a lot of fun.
So I've been in practice in law and in Manchester and for a period of time in Nashua with the same firm since 1985. And as we mentioned, began service in the town in 1992. On the town side, I also have volunteered in schools to coach mock trial teams.
Good.
While my kids were in the school system.
Good. One of the questions, and I think some of the things that people don't know about you, is the thermal heating project that is abutting the library, or people probably see it abutting the library, or probably watched some construction and had no idea what it was about. Can you explain that, and can you explain your involvement in that?
Sure. Really, in 2009, as a fairly new councilor, if you remember, in 2008, we had energy prices go up to inflation-adjusted what have turned out to be historically high levels, and they hit everybody hard, including our town budget for heating and vehicle fuels. And so I went to the Municipal Association annual meeting, and I saw what other towns were doing in the energy area and was somewhat surprised that we were behind some prominent university communities. You'd expect to be leading the charge, but other communities were involved as well. So came back, crafted a document to form the Town Energy Commission. At the same time in the legislature, they were working on legislation to allow energy commissions. There were citizen energy committees. Working from the inside as a commission, an official Board of Commission of the town is, I think, much more productive because you need the support of the governing body to get things done. So I drafted what I thought would be a good charter document for the Energy Commission. Right. We got the support of the majority of the council, came into being in July of 2009, actually before Governor Lynch signed the bill into effectiveness, and had an energy commission filled on the day the law became effective.
Wow,
so what it put us in a position to do, which really is the groundwork for the geothermal project, was to put us into competition with some then federal programs or federally funded programs to do energy audits and studies. So we began studying our municipal buildings. We also, through that same program, got a $100,000+ grant for the McKelvey School to upgrade its boilers. It had two boilers. They were upgraded to Energy Star boilers in that process. We had audits done. It became clear that the library was the poorest or the most energy intensive building. The safety complex is bigger. It uses more energy. But the library was the most intensive user. Part of that makes sense because it's open retail store hours. Right. But it was a building that we knew needed some attention. You would also know by the giant ice dams that were forming from the roof that the building was leaking heat like crazy. And the system really couldn't keep up with it. On a cold winter day, it would be in the 50s in the building. So long story short, we had a number of different studies that established grounds for and good data for making energy improvements to the building. When we passed the infrastructure bond in 2011, it happened to be time to replace the roof, which was prematurely worn out because of the thermal changes in the building. Right. And it became a time when we could use closed cell insulation in the attic. So we did that project, and as a really a precondition of doing something like a renewable energy product, you have to first take care of the building envelope. So we had the studies in place. We had spent the money to take care of the building envelope, and the HVAC system in the library, which just hit its 20th year, had reached the end of its useful life. And so we had budgeted $500,000 to replace it with a conventional system.
One of the phrases you used there was, and I apologize for this, but used what you said was HVAC. And believe it or not, my ears picked up on 8-track. And I thought, wait a minute. And then as you kept speaking, I thought, HVAC. Okay, we're looking at heating
ventilating, and air conditioning. Right.
Great. I'm sure people knew it, but just in case.
Well, I hope. But, you know, these acronyms we all get used to.
Right, and 8-track dates me tremendously.
So, at any rate, as part of that insulation project, we, in discussion with the engineer overseeing that job, the subject of geothermal came up. I had really no special knowledge about geothermal, and nothing was done over the course of 2 years, but then it became time to replace the system. And really thanks to my wife and the assistant director at the library, they asked for evaluation of alternative to conventional systems, and there were four systems ultimately looked at. Some of them were more efficient than conventional oil-fired and conventional cooling tower, but would require some substantial alterations to the building and were not feasible for that reason. And the one that, even though it costs more to begin with, produced the most savings and the fastest payback of the investment was geothermal. And that created a $383,000 funding gap. And by virtue of having been a counselor for so long and having been involved in the energy area for so long, I am regularly getting information about grants. And so over the course of the summer, you know, in a quandary about how would we fund this wonderful thing we know will pay for itself, but right. We know taxpayers and the council will not want to front the money to do this, and we don't have it in the budget. How do we bridge this gap? So, Public Utilities has a renewable energy fund.
Yes.
We knew we could apply for a grant, so we all agreed at town offices. Then Steve Daly was town manager, Jim Stanford, that we would pursue it. The question was, how do you get a grant written by that speaks the language of tons of carbon dioxide saved? We knew dollars, we knew BTUs, but we didn't know the language of the PUC. And again, by virtue of having been on the Energy Commission and knowing people, I knew a consultant that we could either get a referral from or they would actually do it. And they did, and they've been assisting us or have assisted us through the process. So it was a nail biter in front of the executive council. It was a lot of money for them, but ultimately we persuaded them to go along with it. I think of 20 projects that came before the PUC. We were, I think Durham got a huge PV thing, but we were the second-ranked project and we're the first and maybe only geothermal to be approved through that program. Along with that, I also knew we could get, through Eversource, a rebate because we're using more efficient equipment. And so that's an additional $50,000. So we have gotten funding above and beyond the incremental cost of geothermal.
When is the payback complete?
It probably is about year 12 or 13, and that's a little uncertain because the price of oil's gone down.
Right.
And so we compare it to the price of fuel oil. What is really great about it is our last oil bill in the library was May of 2016. So we've gone through the whole heating season without paying a dime for any heating fuel. The new components are so efficient that even though we're extracting heat or depositing heat in the ground to heat and cool, our electricity bills are lower than they were supporting a cooling tower in the summer, the lights, everything.
So you're looking at probably, 2025?
And it will have paid for the whole system.
Yes.
Not just the geothermal, but the whole system.
After that, you'll be heating the library, cooling the library for virtually nothing.
For virtually nothing. We also, although there's some arcane process you have to go through, we have thermal renewable energy credits that we can get paid for.
Nice.
That we submit annually. And the geothermal wells, there's 20 of them. You wouldn't know they're there. They're covered by a field now. They can be covered by a parking lot in the future. Those things are warranted for 50 years, and that's only because nobody's had them for more than 50 years.
I think people if we just briefly describe what is geothermal.
Geothermal in this case is a closed-loop system. There are 20 wells that are drilled about 500 feet deep. They are filled with grout, like a cement, with a loop of plastic pipe going through them. They all they don't come into contact with the ground or groundwater. It's a closed loop. In them is a solution of glycol and water, which is a non-freezing heat exchange fluid. There's a heat exchanger in the library that either deposits heat, if it's summer, into the well system to get cooled off. The ground is pretty much a constant 55 degrees or so.
Okay.
So you can deposit heat in the summer, you can extract heat in the winter, and then it goes into essentially a conventional system in the library with heat pumps. That's the way the system was always designed. So there are 40-some-odd heat pumps in the building, same as there always were. Those extract from another loop of cooling and heating medium.
Another area, talking about wells, might transition, if you don't mind.
Before we leave that, there is a great interactive touch panel display now in the downstairs atrium of the library. You can look and see what the temperature of the wells are and every single pump.
That's awesome.
And pictures of the project from the groundbreaking to now.
Going back to your discussion of wells, we've certainly had some issues with wells here in town.
We have. It's been an eventful year. 2016 was for water because we started out just thinking that we might have a stormwater issue with the federal government and new regulations. We ended up having the discovery in February of 2016, PFOAs from the Saint-Gobain
experience,
In Merrimack, and it turns out with testing that it is cropping up at landfills, including the Merrimack landfill right across the Bedford town line. Although it is confined at our own landfill, one of our tests, our monitoring wells, has an elevated level of PFOAs in it. It was just an ubiquitous chemical. Every piece of furniture, upholstery, and rug had PFOAs in the 60s Scotch guarding, and your house was not complete if you didn't have a spray can.
So you didn't think it was going to be harmful, and all of a sudden it turns around and comes back.
And part of it is that we now can test in parts per trillion testing previously at parts per billion would come back negative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so more refined testing now to make sure, just to double check, triple check now.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things is we did not have a groundwater standard in New Hampshire. And it seemed as if the EPA was going for a 100 part per trillion standard as they had adopted in Maine. And that was the way it was. They had been studying it for about a dozen years, but without coming up with a groundwater standard. Right. Vermont was 20. I and others felt that Bedford citizens would not be very pleased with 100. And so we worked with our federal delegation, federal Senator Ayotte and Senator Shaheen's office, and spoke with them, explained our point of view about what it should be. And we ended up with a 70 EPA standard. And I don't know if we had a direct influence on the process, but I think our voice was heard.
That's great. That's good. Effects of the drought.
Effects of the drought.
And could you bring it up to currently? Right now we're looking at, we're just before the elections here in the winter. So where are we in terms of drought?
We are still in severe drought.
Okay.
This snowfall that we've gotten last week and this week may pull us out of that into serious drought. But for most of last year, we were either in severe or extreme drought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly heard from plenty of people around town whose wells had either gone dry, people who spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to either drill their wells deeper or drill additional wells on their property. It's not something that has never been encountered in the history of Bedford. We have a tough water situation here in the part that's in bedrock anyway. But many more reports of wells going dry. And I know that we've met with our state legislators, and I don't know how our bill is going, but we can, as a town council, can regulate just a small fraction of the water users in town.
So, right. I know, too, it happened while I was a councilor. It wasn't nearly as severe as right now, but one of the big questions we had is fire suppression. And how are we doing using water for fire suppression?
Over time, we have had some expansion of public water. So we do have some hydrants. You know, it's better than it was 20 years ago.
Yes, thank you. Yep.
So,
yes.
Is it good? No, it's not at all good. As you get to the northwest part of town, as those bodies of water dry out, you know, there isn't any ready supply.
Right.
But fortunately, we have a hydrant now up around Riddle Road. Some other hydrants down by Jenkins Road in the Hannaford area. So it is definitely better than it once was.
Okay.
But to the degree that we rely on fire ponds, you know, those are subject to
weather. We're still a rural community,
weather.
For all intents and purposes.
We have some cisterns that are in place with new developments. So there is a limited but significant supply of water, you know, even if it's not in that particular development that the fire department.
And, of course, you'll probably be looking at this when you go into the 10-year planning process. Where is that right now, that 10-year planning process?
We will begin with our consultants in 2018. This year, and really since the infrastructure bond, we have, you know, one thing we wanted to do for certain with that is look at and see what our pending problems were with just plain maintenance of buildings, because we had plenty of those. But we also wanted, there were two other pieces of that. One was a needs assessment, so we could look at how do we efficiently house our staff and get the business of the town done. Because, you know, as you know, in the 90s is when we added safety complex, town offices, library. We've absorbed a lot of growth since then and have not expanded those facilities. And those facilities are now 20, 25 years old and need attention. So it is a time when we need to assess what is the best strategy for expanding. We bought the safety subcomplex property down on South River Road. What ultimately will go there is to be determined, but that's one of the pieces in play.
Right. Okay. Good. Back, if I can, I apologize for lurching out there to the 10-year plan, but it's important. It's also going to be important with this concept of MS4.
Yes.
I think people have heard MS4, but again, it's like hearing something else, and you go, what is that? What's that about?
Yeah. Can you? Well, in New Hampshire, well, there are four states in the country that allow the EPA to regulate stormwater.
Yep. And I know from history that stormwater. Explain stormwater.
Well, stormwater has a rather broad definition, right, according to the EPA. Virtually anything that enters a drainage swale that is owned by the town, or a pipe, however long or short it might be, that is owned by the town, that ultimately finds its way into a stream,
river,
large enough body, right, of water or river, is stormwater, and it's regulated under the Clean Water Act, or they construe their authority as broad enough,
right,
to regulate,
right,
it.
Right.
So working with the Department of Environmental Services, there is an assessment of impaired waterways in the state. We are now working on the 2012 list of impaired waterways. Everybody's made improvements since then. The 2014 list has just been submitted to the EPA. We have some streams that we know are impaired on that list that will be appearing newly. McQuesten Brook that goes through our TIF district, mm-hmm, where we paid $1.5 million to be able to develop it, has an impaired stream for chlorine, which is from road salt.
Sure.
As does McQuaid Brook, which goes through our commercial district on Route 101. But also if somebody has the idea of doing some residential development on McQuaid Brook all the way up to the Goffstown line, that's affected as well by chlorine.
Right. I think people don't realize that fertilizers.
Yes.
Fertilizers, salt on the driveway, any items like that impact the water quality that runs off of their system.
Right. And then once it enters the town road drainage system, the town is legally responsible for its quality.
Right. And that's it. So what is MS4 then, and how does it impact? Why do we care? I think that's, and I doubt that's an expense. I know that's an expense.
Yeah. Well, MS4 is the
acronym.
Yeah, an acronym for various kinds of municipal waters that are impaired. But basically, we are going to be under the strictest rules in the nation. Massachusetts will be in 4 months. We will be in 16 months. And it'll do things like in a place like our TIF district, where we have a chlorine-impaired stream, we cannot do anything that will cause any further degradation of that or contribute to cause it. And so that means virtually no new parking lots or driveways, whether it's a residential parking lot or a commercial parking lot, mm-hmm, can be added without the permission of the EPA. We know the EPA takes years to make decisions on things. The magnitude of requests that we will be submitting here in New Hampshire, roughly 43 of our biggest municipalities are involved in this,
right,
pales in comparison to the requests Massachusetts will be making.
Right.
And when you're looking at attracting new development to town and talking about delays in approvals, that is going to kill our ability to add to our tax base. And that, and then we're going to have to pay for improvements to.
And this is why Bedford and other municipalities have asked the state to take over some of the responsibilities, mm-hmm, that EPA has. Some people looked at it as kind of silly that we would ask the EPA for permission to take over their responsibility, right, but that gives us, the state, and their communities, a lot more flexibility.
It does. Number one, lets us deal with people we're familiar to dealing with, and
right,
that know conditions here in New Hampshire. If we have had an abnormal winter with a lot of, even though we haven't had until the last week, a lot of snow, we've had a lot of days when there's been slippery conditions on the road. Everybody has to use road salt. We don't want to be in a position where it is February 15th and we have to say we've used our allotment of road salt. Don't go out driving to work or school if there's black ice because we can't treat it.
Just looking at the time, Chris, and I'm sorry, it's great. Road work. Tell me about what you foresee the need for our constantly upgraded roads that we have.
Several years ago, we passed a $30 million road bond. We did our first issue of the road bond. We will do our second issue this maybe March. Mm-hmm. In fact, interest rates are still good. We're seeing the Fed ratchet them up, but I think we will still get a good rate on that bond. And that will enable us to do a couple more years in the local roads program. And then we have another bond issue after that that will follow. That will maybe not put us in a maintenance mode, but will get us awfully close where we will try and get by with our annual road budget rather than continually having to bond.
And speaking of roads, can you give us an idea of what 101 update looks like?
Sure. We're looking forward to some work getting started this summer, and it may only be clearing some trees along the right-of-way, but surveying has been done by the state. Easements have been acquired by the state, and there I don't anticipate any disruption of traffic other than maybe a vehicle on the shoulder of the road and or maybe a flagger out there to make sure people slow down. But this summer, I think things will be relatively quiet and people will start to see some activity, which is encouraging. And then 2018, we will be at it in earnest, and people will be finding different routes through neighborhoods.
Right. Learn Bedford differently. Yeah, right. We have, unfortunately, just a little bit of time left, but thank you for, I think, the background of the, how we're spending money. And I know if you could just give a couple of minutes on the budget and the work you've done. I know I'm familiar with the work that goes into a budget. Where are we on the budget?
Well, we're at a point we're very pleased to say that although we've absorbed a retirement system increase that was not insubstantial, and we absorbed an increase in insurance premiums that was not insubstantial, we do have a 4% tax decrease in the town this coming
year. Awesome.
So that includes funding pavement of the field by the Little Leagues, which will serve as, right now it's an unpaved parking lot for school use. When school is out, I envision that in the future as being public parking for businesses on Route 101. And as you know, on this side of 101, we're always tight for parking. So,
wrapping it up, can you tell the folks why they should elect you?
Okay. First of all, thank you, Dave, and thank you
welcome.
For your service in the state legislature and all your service in town.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
My continuous service pales by 25 years pales by your years.
Thanks.
This is a time when it may not seem critical, but it is, I think, critical that we continue to elect somebody like myself who is experienced, both in terms of the history of the town, which gives a good sense of where we are, but also gives a good sense of where we're going in the future. We are, as mentioned earlier, about to engage in the 10-year master plan update process. We have some very important issues going with our water infrastructure, both stormwater in a way to moderate what we foresee happening in 16 months so that we can continue to develop our town the way we look forward to developing our town, and also so that we can have good quality water. Just because we are trying to limit what the EPA does to restrict water quality, we know acutely that we have a water shortage in town and that we have a water contamination problem in town that is not going away.
Well, thank you again for all that you've done, and hopefully we'll continue to do. Good luck in this election.
Thank you.
But I want to thank you very much, Chris, and thanks for being here tonight.
Okay, thank you.